Hey, got the morning show with Aaron, and I want to welcome Dougal Greer to the studio. You were presenting to the EPA last week about sediment plume modelling because you are an oceanographer, a coastal oceanographer. It's very precise. Science gets very precise, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
You don't know everything about the ocean.
Exactly. You got to keep an ear
in. Yeah, only the ocean on the coast.
Yep.
And only sediment plume modelling? Is that what you grew up wanting to do, sediment plume modelling?
I dreamt of it. Ever since I was five, I've dreamt of nothing but sediment plumes. Yeah.
It's a little bit alarming. Before we get into it, I'm actually curious to know, how did you get to where you are? Like, what did you study and why did you end up in this particular direction?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a wiggly road to get here. So I studied physics originally.
Okay.
And then machine learning. Before machine learning was a thing, it was a kind of a hobby master's to do, but it turned into quite a big thing. And then statistics after that, all the fun ones. And then I came to Raglan, and I mean, it might sound different, but physical oceanography, coastal oceanography is all, it's all the same stuff as physics, right? It's all maths and computers and algorithms.
Number crunching.
That kind of thing. And I luckily got my toe in the door working in that area. And yeah, that was back in 2007. And I've been nerding out ever since. It's been great.
Right. And if we look you up online, it says you're still working at eCoast, but...
Well, as of recently, I'm with Orcas Consulting, which is a new enterprise with me and Jose Barrero.
Right.
Yeah.
And
Dr. Jose Barrero, yeah.
Marine.
I drop the doctor when I'm talking to him.
He lets you do that.
Yeah. We're on those terms.
It's crazy informal.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you've been crunching the numbers on sediment plume modeling. And basically, if we could do it in one sentence, what did you tell the EPA?
What did I tell the EPA? Well, so basically the...
In one sentence,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I do this to musicians as well.
Just a minute where you have to keep talking for a minute without pausing. So they put in their application, and part of that application is sediment plume modeling, which tells you where they expect the sediment to go as part of the mining. And I'm there reviewing that plume modeling. And the application is the same application that they put in 2017. I think in the brief summary of what I was saying, I'm going to have to use a lot of commas to keep this to one sentence, is that being the same application, computing power has moved on. There's a lot of changes they could have made.
Yes.
There were mistakes pointed out back in 2017, which haven't been addressed. There have been new locations found, reefs around the area. They haven't been included in the analysis. There's a lot of just best practice which kind of isn't being followed in the application, and this is a very big operation that they're proposing. So from that point of view, I suppose the one sentence summary is that it hasn't really followed best practice, and there are holes in the modeling study that haven't been addressed.
Right, so they already were, and now things are worse.
And so
you've been doing... So do you just look at their research and critique it, or do you do some of your own?
No, I mean, I do this kind of work myself. That's the day job, the bread and butter.
Yeah.
So in this capacity, I'm a kind of a peer review for this. So basically just looking at their reports. I mean, I'm doing various calculations and little bits and pieces, but I'm not redoing the modeling or anything. I'm just looking at the work that they're doing.
Because someone would have to pay you to do that, wouldn't they? Or you could do it in your spare time in the evening.
I could too, yeah.
Is that realistic though?
No, it's big. It's a big job, you know.
Yeah,
it takes
right.
months. I mean, often you take on this kind of project and it goes for a year or several years. So it's big stuff.
Okay, so you could maybe see why they didn't want to revisit the science again. If they're cheap.
If you're being cheap about it, I think they've got deep enough pockets. And I don't think this is a huge component of it. And, you know, they've got the framework set up. They could have updated the modelling that they had.
Okay.
So it's not like they had to start from scratch again.
Yeah. How long have they had? They've had quite a few months before they turned up last week, didn't they, where they could have?
They had a few, yeah. So, I mean, the original work, so the last submission was 2017, but the work was done in 2015, so it's been they've had 9 years to, well, I guess 7 years since the last submission or decision. So that was what I was sort of expecting, that they would have done some more work.
I think people are surprised. I don't know if that's been reflected in other parts of other different science areas, like the benthic life and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, so in 2022, now this might have caught them off guard, I guess, but that was, I guess, a couple of years ago as well. There was a publication where they went out with surveying the seabed and they found a whole bunch of new reefs. So reefs, when you're looking in that area out there, you know, there's a lot of sand, so the reefs are very important because, I'm not an ecologist, but you don't need to be to know that reefs are very important in terms of supporting sea life and, you know, creating larvae and where they breed. And
how deep, Phil told us the other day, I can't remember, but this is relatively shallow, like there's
it's about 40 meters, roughly, plus or minus 10. So it goes from about, I think it's from 30 to about 50 meters deep, yeah.
A long way out, like how far out? Like,
oh, God, I don't actually have the number of how far offshore it is.
But it's not like hundreds of meters, it's more like hundreds of kilometers.
Yeah, it's quite far offshore, yeah.
Yeah. So substantial.
So I guess, and the thing that they said in that report was that they think that there's lots more reefs. They only looked in patches and they found a lot of reefs.
So who was doing that work?
It was Morrison is the name of the guy, but I think it might be a NIWA publication.
Right.
But there's a few different bodies that were involved with it. Karen Pratt
was it aimed at that area because they knew that was an area of interest? Like,
yeah, it was. And I think some of it was involved with the local kind of diving club. So they might have had ideas about where there were reefs, right?
Yeah.
But there was a conclusion that they think there's probably lots more out there if you go looking. So, and part of one of the sort of conditions that TTR were considering putting in was, well, if we get consent to do this, then we'll go looking for more. And that's sort of backwards to how you normally do it. Normally you identify the areas you're concerned with, do the modeling, and then the modeling kind of says, okay, well, you know, what are the impacts in these areas that are important?
Well, the whole point of the EPA and the hearings to determine if it's wise to go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that the big picture of what we're doing here?
Yeah, that's it.
And they're saying, oh, just give us the license anyway and we'll do that stuff afterwards.
Yeah, and then we'll do a bunch of monitoring, and so there's a lot of, like, we'll do things after the fact. And, so you're talking to the DMC, the decision-making committee, down there, and, I mean, there are four people working really hard, and they're trying to digest a huge amount of information from economics through to sediment plume modelling through to everything. And
Is there someone on there who understands your science?
There isn't really a physical person. I know that there's definitely an ecologist on there.
Yeah.
I will say that the DMC this time round, this is my third time doing this.
Right.
I've been doing this since 2013 on this whole TTR thing. And they seem pretty engaged. They're asking good questions. So that's good.
Yeah. And I mean, I was hearing bad things about the previous decision-making committee, and that's the one that ended up at the Supreme Court with points of law being pointed out to the... Yeah, so... No surprise in a lot of ways of that. So when you do the modelling, let's go through the process of what actually happens. For people who don't know, they have a big monster machine. We'll just call it a big monster machine. And it is big, and it goes, and they dump it on the seafloor, carefully probably. Careful actually doesn't seem like a word that's appropriate for what they're doing. And you were just saying to me off the air that they dig down an average of five or six meters, but sometimes as deep as 11 meters.
Yeah, that's right,
with this machine. And then what happens, it gets sucked up to a ship?
So it gets sucked up to a ship.
Yeah.
They use sort of, you know, magnets, sort of giant magnets to suck out the iron components, and then there's grinding.
That's on the ship.
Yeah. And then basically what they don't need goes back through a pipe and gets put out near the seabed through a big pipe.
Right.
And there's about 50 million tons gets processed every year if they get it, and they will go on for 30 years. So then the sediment comes out through the pipe.
50 million. 50 million. Let me just write that down.
It's a big operation. I'll just give for context. I was looking at a while ago, I was reviewing dredging stuff in Littleton Harbour. And, you know, that's a reasonable size dredging operation, and they're looking at maintenance dredging of about a million a year. So
it's just to make sure the big ships can get in.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay.
So this is a big operation. So anyway, the sediment comes out the pipe, and you've got all sorts of different sediment. You've got sand, you've got fine material. The sand settles straight to the seabed. You know, it's heavy, so dense, so it falls quite quickly. But it's the fine stuff that we really care about. How much of that escapes from the mining pit, and then where does that go as a passive plume getting pushed around by the local currents? And then it settles, and then it gets resuspended and pushed around some more.
Oh, okay. So it's not just like it gracefully falls to the bottom of the ocean and that's that. Because it's so light. Like, how small are the small particles?
Well, I think that's a I could.
We're talking microns.
Don't send me off in it. Yeah, we are talking microns, but it's complicated because they stick together into these little balls called flocks, and then so they create bigger balls, and that's the whole process too that has to be summarized in the modeling. So you have to think as well, there's a bit of sorting that goes on. It's normally all the different parts of sediment are locked up together, but when you put it out through the pipe, the heavy stuff falls first, and then the light stuff falls on top of that. So you've got a kind of a thin layer of light stuff on top, which can be resuspended easily.
Just sweep of your hand. We all know you sweep your hand in the water and the stuff.
And up comes the sweep of a wave, of which there are plenty on the West Coast.
And I guess it's not that deep that it's not affected by the waves. Like if you're talking about the deep sea, which is a whole other issue, but imagine the action with the waves above doesn't affect the deep, deep sea that much. But
well, this is the thing. This was actually a point that we talked about quite a lot.
Or it does anyway?
Well, see, okay. Can I go in the weeds a tiny bit?
Yeah, go for it, man. Go for it. Yep.
So one of the things is that they assumed a wave with a period of 7 seconds. And that, small period wave. So think of wind chop, you know?
Yeah.
I assume I might be talking to some surfers out there who
I know, and they're thinking seven's pretty short.
Not very representative of the actual waves we get on the... You know, this would not be a surf destination if the waves here were 7 second period as standard. Now, a 7 second wave, wind chop basically, just jiggles around near the surface, right? But when you get, say, 13 second waves, which is more representative, they actually penetrate way down. They can penetrate hundreds of meters. So if you were a 13 second wave, if you were down at 100 meters, you would still be jiggling you back and forwards on the seabed. 7 second wave wouldn't.
Yeah.
So if they had used a higher period wave in their modeling, they would have created more stirring at the seabed, more resuspension. At the plume in the pit. So they underestimated the wave period. That was one of my criticisms in 2017, wasn't addressed.
That's pretty fundamental.
It's driving how much of the fine sediment escapes from the mining pit, and they underestimated a pretty key driver. So that was one of my big sort of criticisms.
I've seen discussions between scientists get really personal. I mean, you're basically saying they've done very bad science. You don't want to use those words, but that's the implication. That seems so fundamental to me. Like we know the wave period of that part of the ocean.
We do, and I think any surfer who checks the surf forecast with any regularity would hear 7 seconds and would have. You don't need to be a.
I read the surf report every day, and I don't even surf, but I read the report, and I know that seven is just not representative of what we get around here.
Exactly. So that was problematic. I mean, I'm not saying it's all terrible, but I'm saying that there's enough flaws. And when you're talking about an operation this size, you want to dot your I's and make sure you're doing the right stuff. And there was other stuff too that. You know, there's certain reports that are just kind of missing. There's normally a report which discusses what we call trigger levels. So, when the operation actually happens, when sediment levels go above a certain level, when you decide that there's a problem, you know, like let's say the plume has reached an area that you care about, that report just kind of wasn't there for it. So there's some absent stuff there as well. So anyway, I'm going off track, but back to the plume.
The first thing I was thinking is that I wanted to check was you say they put it in a pipe that comes back down.
Yeah.
You said near the seabed. Does it vary? Do we not really know exactly?
It's just a few meters off the seabed, basically. So they try and put it down quite close to the seabed because the closer you put it, the closer it is to just.
Well, what we're calling the seabed was previously about an average of 5 meters below the seabed.
That's right, sir.
At that point in time. So it's something different as well.
Well, sometimes it's the seabed, and then as they dig down, it gets into like a pit. You know, they do it in a lane.
Yeah.
And so there's a pit which can get deeper as they go.
Okay. But they're dropping it in behind them, I imagine.
So the way they do it is they dig the hole and create a mound behind them.
Yeah.
And then as they move along, they backfill, so they dig a pit as they fill in behind them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. All right. We won't get too worried about it. I think that the details, it's the fact that it's 5 meters deep. And we were talking before off the air about how if you tried this on the land, people would just laugh at the application. You know, you can imagine a farm over somewhere on the way to Hamilton having a big machine the size of a building digging down 5 meters and chewing it all up and spitting it back. Like, people would just be astounded. The most environmentally unfriendly member of the population would be appalled by it. You know, it's like, does it matter? But the question is, well, it's the sea. Does it matter so much?
Yeah, there's definitely some kind of level of abstraction that happens in the sea. you know, when it's out there, you lose a sense of scale. Like the area that they're looking to mine is, it's approximately half the size of you know, Greater Hamilton, which if you imagine a mine that size and the size of, on the land, yeah, you'd be pretty concerned about it. And when they looked at the sediment characteristics, they used samples from three locations in that area, which seems, again, if you were to characterize, now it's the seabed, it's not the land, so it's slightly different, but if you were to characterize the sediment around Hamilton by three samples, I think you'd say you'd need a few more samples.
Yeah, and you're talking about there's reefs there, so, I mean, what is a reef made of? Is that of some more substantial rock-like material?
Yeah, sort of rocky
material. And then in other places there's kind of sand and sediment.
Lots of sand, and then they go down
to sediment might be the wrong word.
Yeah, sediment, and it gets kind of soily as well. They're going, you know, they're taking these cores that go down quite deep, so it changes as you go down through there, as it does in soil, right?
So another criticism would be they didn't take enough samples.
There weren't enough samples to really characterize, or at least, you know, we don't know. There might be patches where it's quite different, where the sediment behaves quite differently. So
another question I have too, now that we've established, like when they drop it down, that the sand goes down first, then the slightly smaller bits of sediment. Well, no, I should stop calling it sediment. Well, it's about to become sediment. Yes. That next, and then the really fine stuff eventually settles, but can be washed around again. But when you get really, really fine silt over the tops of things, is that very good for the life of the seabed? I know that's not your area, but that's a question I just have now hearing about it.
It's not. Definitely one of the concerns that. Well, that's one of the things that the ecologists look at. So when it comes to the modelling, the reason we do the modelling. Is we do the modelling, we look at where the plume goes, and we pass it on to ecologists, and they then look at those modelling results and say, well, how, you know, with this level of sediment that's in the water column, this level of sediment that's settling out, how does that affect the marine life?
Yeah.
So I don't really know. I know that settled sediment causes ecological harm, but I'm not an ecologist.
We know from the harbour that one of the things that riparian management on the farms has done has stopped less sediment going into the harbour, and then the life on the seafloor of our harbour has come back, basically.
Yeah.
So we all kind of get that at that kind of level. That's probably more, like, that's repeated sediment. But, so it's not quite a full, perfect comparison. But another question about the sediment, so say they drop it close to the seafloor, does that mean, you think, oh, it's close, that's good, but can it come back up again, the really fine stuff?
Yeah, so some of it, they do the modelling in two parts. They do the near field and the far field. So the near field is trying to understand that really complex behaviour around how does it come out of the pipe and how much of it escapes.
Yeah.
So some of it gets pushed to the seabed and stays there. Yeah. And then a certain percentage of the fines get out. You can imagine it, right? A big lump of sand going down and a big kind of plume coming up around it.
Yeah. Yes, easy. Yeah. And so, okay, so, but that... When does it event? How long is it around? Because it doesn't just, I mean, you said it drops and then it can be swept back up again. Like, how long are we cursed by the sediment for? Like, until it's gone away. Bearing in mind that away is someone else's problem, but it's still a problem.
So it disperses as it goes away.
Yeah,
it disperses to a point. It kind of stays in a bit of a. If you release a big lump of fine sediment, it will stay in a reasonable blob, but disperses slightly as it goes off, and then it gets carried away by the currents, and some of it settles out, some of it carries away, and eventually it's off, you know, sort of dispersed out in the environment. But if you're doing that for 30 years, which is the application time, then you might start to get cumulative effects over that time period.
Are there, we know with currents and the sea that there's sometimes there well, we know with the rubbish that ends up in the sea that there's certain parts of our coast where it all gravitates toward for one reason or another, and other bits are clear, and you know, one end of the beach is clear, the other bit's a mess. So is that one of the problems too, that you might find it all going into sort of one place?
It does to a point.
Or concentrating anyway?
Yeah, and so there's a current called the Derville Current, which it comes down around Taranaki and then sweeps down towards the south.
Yeah.
So it follows broadly. It moves around. It doesn't. It's not always the same. Those currents change over time. But that it gets kind of caught in that current a lot and moves towards the coast to the south.
Right.
Is roughly where it kind of tends to go towards. Now, I will say as well, there was an absence of looking at climate change, so we don't know how things are going to change in the future as well and over the life of the application.
Okay.
So again, that was something that in 2017... maybe we didn't look at climate change as standard in studies, whereas now you never really do a study without having a climate change scenario.
Yeah, which is, as far as I can tell, everything becomes more dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, or things just change sometimes unpredictably, or, you know, things might get a little stormier. I don't know if there's any predictions about the currents down around there, but, you know, thinking about in the Atlantic, you know, thinking about Ireland where I'm from,
yeah.
You know, the Gulf Stream is the thing that keeps the country from turning into a giant freezer, and there's concerns about how that will change with climate change. I don't know whether any of the currents around here will have the same, you know, people have the same concerns, but you would generally look at that.
And are we supposed to be proceeding on the precautionary principle with all of this science?
Yeah, exactly.
So the idea is that you have to prove that it will be okay before you go ahead.
That's right. Yeah,
I've said that in very non-scientific terms, but
no, you're basically there. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That's the idea. And so with the modeling, you tend to be, well, one of the ways you deal with error in the modeling is to be conservative. So you try and be, you know, if you think that you're going to put out between, you know, a low or a high amount of sediment, model the high amount because you want to be conservative. You want to say, well, what's the kind of worst case scenario?
Yeah, and I imagine there's a lot of pressure within TTR to not do that.
Yeah,
I mean, you'd feel it. Like, if you were working for them, you'd be like, oh, I don't want to see that, you know. I just don't want to see that highly conservative modeling. That's not going to be good for us. And that does bring up a question, too, how accurate the modeling is, because it is, I mean, it consists of a series of highly educated estimates, though, isn't it? Like, there's a relative amount of estimation going on.
Yeah, and error creeps in from various places.
Yeah. So you're doing work down at Littleton, but they dredge there all the time, and you can check your modelling to see how accurate it was, I guess.
Yeah, I was in a review capacity down there, so
right.
I was looking at trigger levels. But yeah, you can do checks. So as part of the application as well, they do what we do is a model calibration generally. So you compare, you take a particular location, you measure the amount of sediment in the water column, run the model for that period, call it a hindcast, so it's not a forecast, it's modeling the past, and then you compare what the model said happened with what you measured. And so with the calibrations that they did, there were some quite big spikes which weren't really picked up by the modeling as well. So sediment transport modeling is hard. You know, something wave modeling is pretty straightforward. Current modeling is not too bad as well. Sediment transport modeling can get complicated quickly. So it is a tricky thing to get right, but there were some discrepancies. You know, occasionally there were spikes where the measured signal was 5 or 10 times greater than what the model predicted. So there were times when the model was kind of under predicting quite significantly
where I was going with that was that you described the what's happening at Littleton is very small compared to what's happening every year, or what's proposed to happen by TTR every year off the coast. So, and you can check that, what's happening at Littleton against every year, you do it again. So that's kind of, you can refine it and get accurate. But there's potential to be quite inaccurate at the moment, I would imagine. But especially because of the size, because no one has done this yet, have they? Has anyone done this scale of seabed mining?
Not around here. I don't know about the rest of the world. Ask the chasm people to give you a better answer on.
I don't think there's much. I think
it's certainly unprecedented.
This is why this is so important. It's because it's so early on in the industry.
Yeah, that's it. And there's kind of a lack of regulation in that sense as well. So when you look at things like dredging, for example, or let's say you're doing the modeling for something like a wind farm, there's regulatory bodies that kind of say, you do it like that. You do your application like this. You need to tick these boxes. You need to make sure you've looked at this and this. Whereas this doesn't really have that behind it. So, you know, when you're talking to the DMC, they don't really have much to guide them about what's good enough in terms of the modeling.
Yeah.
Which makes it kind of difficult, right? It also makes it a bit of a leaky sieve that things can get through, because you don't quite know what the checks and balances are for a new technology. I mean, this is certainly new around New Zealand. There is the mining up the coast, right? Tahoroa. But that's a much smaller scale operation.
Yeah, that's quite different. It's the sheer scale of this and the length of time.
Yeah, and like I say, you do lose sense of scale. That, you know, this is 50 times bigger than a reasonably big dredging operation. It's quite big.
And it's also, it's not like they're going to stop at the end of that. if they got approval for it and they went and they did it for 30 years, it seems pretty likely they'll get approval for more, unless it turns to, unless it's a huge environmental disaster.
Yeah, I mean,
and then the people might actually say, no, we got to stop.
Yeah, and even then, I don't really know what the process is.
Yeah,
to stop it, but
because
yeah,
I think this is why there's so much pressure on it, is because this can open the door.
Yeah,
to further applications and
it's a long time scale, so you do need to be pretty careful and pretty sure about what you're doing when you're talking about 30 years plus. You know, it might be 35 or
it just. Again, I keep coming back to, I'm not a scientist, but it just seems that there's so much guessing going on, so much unknown, and you've just talked about more things than I can count, more places that I can count in their submission where they haven't followed best practice or they've just not done some things.
Mm.
And I've got to ask about the scientists doing that, and you may not want to comment, but the way I'm hearing it is that I'm asking the question, if they were here, I'd say to them, are you guys like deliberately doing poor science because that's what's been asked of you?
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, I know you're not going to comment. It's just this is what's in my head now. I'm trying to work this out. And I know there's been things like when I looked into some other areas years ago, like master's students being given some science to do and told to use a particular technique which was outdated and they knew would give a really wide error band. And so then they can say, oh, everything's within the margin of error.
Yeah.
And so the company was able to wave this around saying, it's all within the margin of error, we can't tell.
Yeah.
You know, but they deliberately chosen to use a bad system and pressured a master's student to do the science for them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know that sort of thing happens. That's in a completely different area of science. But that sort of stuff goes on. So I'm sitting here after you've told me all this wondering that. And I know you don't want to bag someone on the radio that you haven't. Do you submit? Who submits for them?
Who are their scientists?
Yeah. But, for TTR, do they go and submit?
So they've got NIWA scientists doing the modelling here.
Yeah.
And another company in England, which is a sort of a big sediment company, doing the near field. So the near field being how much escapes from the mining pit.
Yeah.
And those people then came down and appeared at the hearing and talked as well. So, yeah, sometimes it seems like their opinions are a bit towards TTR, but I mean, having said that, I would imagine if TTR asked them to update the modelling, they would have gladly done so.
Yeah, they're probably sitting there waiting for the call. Like, come on.
So, okay.
All right.
Space.
Well, folks, we've been talking to Dougal Greer, a local sediment plume modelling scientist or coastal oceanographer, we'll call you. Basically, a smart man with a very big computer. If I could reduce you to a slogan.
Well, thanks very much for having me in, Aaron.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you coming in and just talking about that. And I think the main takeaway for me there is that there's all this work that they haven't done that they should have done. And they should have caught up to best practice as well, which has moved on in the last 7 years.
So. That's it. And I think, and just to close as well, I think the thing of concern is whatever happens with this, you know, they may get it or they may not. But there's the very concerning thing that's been coming out recently about the fast tracking of process. And I think that's just worth mentioning that's really scary. The idea that whatever about this particular application, the idea that you're going to start giving the go ahead to things like this and saying we're just going to bypass the science and the effects it's actually scary. If you're going to start doing that kind of thing, you're just throwing away all precaution.
They are. They seem intent. It looks like they've gone around and seen all the things that the environmentalists are most passionate about and said, okay, we're going to do those things.
Yeah.
Because they're also bringing back the live transport of stock to the Middle East.
Mm.
Well, they're talking about that as well. There's a protest on. Okay. Someone sent me an email. There's a protest happening in Hamilton sometime soon about that I've got to read out. So, yeah, it feels like they've got that list and they're going, right, we're going to do all this stuff here.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Dougal, thanks heaps for coming in.
Thanks, Aaron.
Okay, folks, we're going to move on, have a little break, and I'm planning to talk to the Environment Centre later on. I haven't confirmed that interview, though, so we'll see how we go.